is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 50 was recorded on February 16, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Alhambra Partners Chief Investment Strategist Jeffrey Snyder will be joining me as this week's featured interview guest, and we'll be taking a deep dive into the Eurodollar market, which Jeff believes is sending some very important signals that most economists and analysts are missing. Jeff put together a fantastic book of charts and graphs to support his arguments about a global shortage of U.S. dollars, and you're definitely going to want to download it because Jeff will be referring to the charts throughout the interview. Registered users at macrovoices.com can find the download link in your research roundup email. If you haven't registered yet, Patrick will tell you just before the interview where you can get the download.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, that S&P 500 just melted up this week. What a crazy move. What's your thinking on where it's going next?
Well, of course, as we predicted last week, sometimes when you see these breakouts above a key round number resistance level, in this case 2300, oftentimes those rallies have legs. Zero Hedge reported this afternoon, supposedly, that there's one fund that could be behind this. It may be some forced short covering and potentially sending a false signal. It is quite possible, I think, that we could be setting up a blow-off top situation here, and there could be a big move to the downside. Am I trading it? No. Why not? Because I've thought that quite a few times in the last couple of years, and I've been wrong. So I'm taking a breather here, but I certainly am not about to go long this stock market. I think it's definitely overvalued and seriously overbought.
All right. Well, you know, I was looking at that dollar index chart, and it looked like earlier in the week that we were finally getting some real motion in that U.S. dollar index going higher. And then suddenly, just one day, we find ourselves right back near this 100 handle. What's your feeling of where we're going next year?
Well, we touched 101.75 on this rally, and, you know, it was a pretty good move up. I think we're looking at what could be just a normal pullback here. I'm still not too worried. As long as it stays above 99, I think it's fine. I do expect eventually that we'll see this dollar rally resume in earnest, and Jeff is going to have a lot to say in today's feature interview about the dollar situation and why he believes that the dollar index will move much higher on a global shortage of U.S. dollars outside of the United States.
All right, let's move on to my favorite topic with you is crude oil. And once again, another week of churning and burning in this trade range using that 53 pivot. You think it's finally going to break out here?
I sure hope so, but holy cow, something really crazy is going on because this is the fourth week in a row where we have had massively bearish, as in should go down, negative data coming out. Crude oil inventories building 9.5 million barrels this week against analyst expectations of around 1 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma did draw down 700,000 barrels. Gasoline, though, 2.8 million barrel build on inventory. Distillates down 689,000 barrels. So between the 9.5 million barrels of crude, 2.8 million barrels of gasoline, we're looking at massive builds in inventory that have taken us now to an all-time high stock level in the United States. We've never had more crude oil in storage than we do right now this week. Now, I know what you're thinking, folks. Wait a minute, that can't be true because the last time that happened was just about a year ago. And what happened then is it pushed the price of oil all the way down to $26 when we got to record all-time high levels of stock. Wouldn't it do the same thing again this week? Well, I don't know. But for the fourth week in a row, what's happened is we had data that should be sending crude oil prices markedly lower. And minutes after the data, the market takes off to the upside. I have yet to see any explanation that makes sense for why this is happening. Zero Hedge has had some coverage over it. They think it's an algo gone wild. I don't have any way of knowing whether it's human traders or algorithmic trading that's doing this, but somebody is buying the heck out of bearish news, and it's not a coincidence. 4 weeks in a row, right after the bearish news comes out, the tape just takes off to the upside. So how long will it take for this meme that's going around of the market's about to rebalance? How is that rhetoric going to continue in the face of this growing mountain of evidence saying that it's not really happening, at least as reported by the stock reports. It looks like this week the crude build was probably attributable primarily to reductions in crude oil processing runs by refineries. But, you know, okay, why are they not refining as much? Well, because we've had several weeks of gasoline builds. It's no surprise. Art Berman had an excellent piece this week, which is in your research roundup email, talking about why he thinks that we're headed below 50 long before we're headed towards 70 as far as prices. So it doesn't make any sense to me. Something really fishy is going on here, and I can't explain it, Patrick.
Well, let's move on here to gold. Now, gold was consolidating earlier in the week, and suddenly, I guess, in the face of that U.S. dollar weakness, suddenly gold is once again heading up to that 1240 level. What do you think is in store for gold next?
Well, the strength has certainly been impressive, but again, I think the dollar is still in a pause. We were seeing the beginning of the dollar starting to recover back 101 spot 75, almost 102, and it seems in the last day or two we've had this pretty significant pullback back to a 100 handle. I want to see what gold does when the dollar breaks north of 103, and I think that that's coming. So I have been surprised a little bit by the strength here, and it's ironic because my own call several months ago was to watch for a bottom right coincident with or immediately after the FOMC statement where they hiked rates back in December. And sure enough, it seems to be proving out that I called it exactly right. Too bad I didn't trade my own prediction, because by the time that had actually happened, my view had changed and I thought that maybe in the face of more rate hikes coming that we would see gold continue to sell off. Hasn't been happening though. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next, but I'm particularly curious when the dollar rally resumes, which I think it will, what happens to gold then?
All right, now I want to touch on bonds. That 10-year yield jumped about 10 basis points throughout the week as Janet Yellen was testifying, hitting that 2.5 yield, and now it's pulled back to about 245. What do you think is next?
Well, you know, Janet's main statement, I think the most significant thing to come out of the Humphrey Hawkins testimony that she gave to Congress is that she's basically saying in so many words that the Fed is not about to reduce its balance sheet anytime soon. In other words, all these bonds that they acquired through quantitative easing, they're not going to start divesting those until they've had several more rate hikes. So they have plenty of room to provide accommodation if things, you know, start to get rough in the economy. The way I interpret that is I think these rate hikes are going to come harder than they think. I don't think we're going to have as many rate hikes as the Fed would like us to believe. So I don't think you're going to see that happen anytime soon. So it's pretty clear to me that there will be no shrinking of the Fed's balance sheet anytime soon. That has resulted, I think, in, you know, maybe some people had expectations to the contrary and they're adjusting their view and that's affecting rates. I still don't think that we're doing anything more than treading water. Here. We don't have a clear signal. We started to get close to 250, as you said. I think we're back to about 244 now as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. There's no clear signal here as far as I'm concerned. I'm still waiting to see what happens.
Thanks for the market update, Eric. Back to join us again as this week's featured interview guest is Jeffrey Snyder. He is the Chief Investment Strategist and Head of Global Research at Alhambra Investment Partners. Please stay tuned after the interview as Eric and I will be back to talk about the hot topic of trading volatility futures and the corresponding VIX ETN products. We strongly recommend that you download the chart book that accompanies this interview as Eric and Jeff will be referring it throughout the interview. Registered users at macrovoices.com already received the download link in your research roundup email. If you haven't already registered, go to macrovoices.com and look at the write-up for Jeffrey's interview. If you look at the bottom of the page, you'll find the instructions on how to register and to download the PDF chart book. Eric's interview with Jeffrey is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Jeffrey Snyder from Alhambra Partners joins me now as this week's featured interview guest. Jeff put together a fantastic book of charts and graphs to support this interview, and I strongly encourage you to download it so that you can refer to it while you're listening. Registered users at macrovoices.com will find the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not yet registered, Patrick told you earlier in the show how to get registered and get the download. Jeff, your last interview back in August was one of our most popular shows ever, but we also lost a few people because we dove straight into the intricacies of the Eurodollar futures market without stopping to first define what a Eurodollar is and why that's important. So to set the stage for this interview, the term Eurodollar refers to time deposits at banks outside the United States, which are denominated in U.S. dollars. So in other words, U.S. dollars on deposit outside of the United States. The term Eurodollar originally referred to bank deposits in Europe, but in today's usage, it really refers to any place in the world that U.S. dollars are on deposit in banks other than U.S. banks. Now, at first glance, it might seem that the Eurodollar market would only be of interest to international corporations who need to hold dollar-denominated deposits around the world. So it's tempting to question why an investor located in the United States would even care about Eurodollars. So, Jeff, let's start by answering that question. What signals can the Eurodollar market give us about the global economy? Why is it so important for an investor who seeks to understand the global economy to understand the Eurodollar market and the messages that it's sending us?
Well, first of all, Eric, thank you for having me back. I really appreciate the opportunity. I think you guys do a fantastic job with your podcast, and I'm a big fan of it, too. To answer your question, the Eurodollar is, as you described it, it's an offshore currency market of various forms. And as it evolved in the last half century or so, it's taken on far more proportions than just deposit accounts or bland vanilla currency transactions. In fact, it's become sort of ubiquitous. What I mean by that is that there's Eurodollars pretty much behind every facet of global finance and economy. If you look back at 2008, for example, the panic in 2008 was actually a Eurodollar panic, not specifically one of Wall Street, but one of Lombard Street. And you're correct to point out that the name Eurodollar is sort of a misnomer because it denotes any offshore currency transactions that happen all over the world. It just so happened that the earliest markets of these offshore dollar areas happen to be in Europe, London, Zurich, Frankfurt. But there was Eurodollar markets all over the world. Montreal was one. Tokyo is another big one. And so there's a global system that is a currency system, a reserve currency system that really isn't currency, though. And it functions in a lot of ways that are, to our first blush, kind of strange and unusual and maybe a little bit too unfamiliar to be to allow comfortable interpretation.
Okay, and of course, the Eurodollar spread to treasuries is very commonly cited, known as the TED spread, as a gauge of risk in the banking system. So there's a lot of reasons to pay attention to this. Let's go ahead and move on to your chart book. On page 2, we see that the 10-year swap spread, which had been positive for the last several years, went negative in late 2015, and it's stayed negative ever since. So first of all, what swap are we talking about here? 10-year what swapped for what? And then please explain what message is being sent by this spread turning negative.
Well, the swap spread is essentially the price of the quoted price of the interest rate swap at the 10-year maturity minus the equivalent 10-year maturity U.S. Treasury rate. And the swap spread is supposed to be a measure of risk in the financial system from the perspective of the swap market. And if you analyze the swap spread, especially a negative swap spread, on a fundamental basis, it doesn't make any sense. Because what a negative swap spread says, and that's again, the quoted price of the interest rate swap below the U.S. Treasury yield, what it says is that the swap market views the counterparty in that interest rate swap as less of a risk than the U.S. government. And of course, that's just not the case. I mean, a negative swap spread on fundamental terms is nonsense. And so what is important about a negative swap spread, especially if it persists, is not what it's about particularly risk in the environment of the swap markets, but rather that there's something nonsensical about it. And so what's important is that nonsense rather than trying to interpret what it actually means.
On page 3, we're moving on to a comparison of Treasury repo rates with the Fed funds rate. What is this chart telling us?
It's actually quite similar to the swap spread chart in the same manner in which I described it. In other words, what we're really getting at here is that money market rates are supposed to be described and function with a determined hierarchy. Things are supposed to work in order. In other words, the swap rate is supposed to be above the treasury rate because that's the way it makes sense in all of the economic and finance textbooks that have ever been written. You know, the treasury market gives us the risk-free rate, and therefore any other rates that are related to it should be at a positive premium. In the repo market and the federal funds market, for example, there's a similar hierarchy. The repo is a secured overnight or term interbank lending transaction where federal funds or LIBOR are unsecured. Therefore, the repo rate should always, always be below the federal funds, or actually the other way around. The federal funds should always be above the repo rate because that should represent additional risk. And so what we see quite commonly since August 2007 is that that hierarchy is broken down here. Again, just like the swap spreads, what is supposed to happen isn't happening, and it doesn't happen over a persisting and stubborn length of time. And so that tells us again that there's something wrong here. The hierarchy of these money markets has broken down.
And it looks like we've got more of this story with some more evidence of that on pages 4 and 5. What's going on there?
Yeah, these are cross-currency basis swaps. And cross-currency basis swaps, you know, without getting into too much about what they are, it's a similar thing. You know, there should be no large negative or positive premium within them. And if there is, it should be closed relatively quickly, again, because there's supposed to be a hierarchy at play here. And one of the things in cross-currency basis swaps that just jumps out at you is, if you read it properly, what it tells you is there's a huge amount of money to be made taking that trade. At a negative premium with the Japanese yen, for example, you can buy any kind of Japanese government bond at a negative yield and still make a killing on the trade because the negative basis is so large. So the question is, for all of these charts so far has been, is where are the people arbitraging away these spreads? Because that's what's supposed to happen. That's what hierarchy really means. Hierarchy is, or at least was, where there was somebody in the middle of all these markets, money dealers, who would take the other sides of these trades and never let these spreads get out of hand so that they started into these nonsensical trading patterns, and let alone persisting in those nonsensical trading patterns. And so what we're seeing here, whether it be swap spread, the repo rate relationship to unsecured, or cross-currency basis swaps, is the absence of hierarchy, and from that we can infer the absence of money dealers in these markets.
I want to pick up on that theme of the available arbitrages not being taken, because on page 6, you're talking about covered interest parity, and for any of our listeners who may not be familiar with that term, it has very long been recognized that the interest rate that's implied by foreign exchange swap markets has to match the prevailing interest rate in the cash market, and the reason for that is very simple. If it didn't match, it would create a risk-free arbitrage opportunity. So this rule depends on the strongest known force in the universe, which of course is the greed of bankers. So, you know, if these rates don't match, that means that bankers are leaving profits on the table. They have a risk-free opportunity to profit from a trade, and they're not doing it. Now, Jeff, how is that possible? Because what you're saying here is that bankers are not taking profits, that it's not a question of risking money, you know, on a speculation, but they have completely risk-free profit opportunities, and they're not taking the bait. So what's going on? What would cause that, and what conclusion should we draw from the fact that they're not taking the bait?
Well, there's a couple things that we conclude. And number one is the fact that the mainstream of economic thought, if you will, the orthodoxy of economic theory is starting to notice this kind of thing, tells you that it's a very serious problem. And apologies to any economists who might be listening to this podcast, but I take a very dim view of economists for this reason. It shouldn't have taken them 10 years to figure this out, because these kinds of things have become fairly common. But you're right. I mean, it was an immutable law of finance that this kind of thing doesn't happen. It shouldn't happen. In fact, it was believed that it couldn't happen. When the swap spread, the 30-year swap spread, turned negative in 2008, for example, for the first time, there were rumors that trading machines wouldn't even allow a negative input because it was theorized to be impossible. And so the fact that it's not only occurred, but has continued to occur, and not only has continued to occur, but has proliferated, tells us that where are these greedy bankers? And so we know pretty well that they're not there. And so there must be some kind of issue with the banking system where they're not taking all of these invitations for essentially free arbitrage, risk-free arbitrage. If they're unable to do that, then the reason that they're unable to do that is very powerful in terms of explaining where we are and how we got here.
On pages 8 and 9, you're showing Treasury International Capital, or TIC report data. Because I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with different TIC report, I want to just stress that on this particular chart, we're not talking about foreign holdings of U.S. Treasuries, which is the most commonly quoted statistic from the TIC reports. You're talking about something different here. So let's start with what you're talking about, U.S. banking data. What does that mean in the TIC reports? And then from there, let's move on to what is this chart telling us?
Sure. And the reason I wanted to bring up the TIC report and the banking data was to further establish the point I made before, which is if we're seeing an absence of banks in these arbitrage situations, you know, where are the money dealers? We should be able to see that somewhere. That shouldn't just be a conjecture. We should be able to find that somewhere in hard data. And the TIC data is actually quite deep. And there's a lot of detail to it that isn't usually perhaps widely disseminated that should be. So there's a lot of valuable data included within it, and part of that is U.S. banking cross-border transactions. And remember, we're talking about the Eurodollar system, which is essentially an offshore dollar system, which by its very nature would lead to a great deal of cross-border transactions, all in dollars. And so U.S. banks provide dollars to this offshore market as well as source dollars from it. And so what the TIC banking data tells us is essentially the fluidity of cross-border transactions within it. From that, we can infer whether or not it's functioning properly or malfunctioning. And this chart specifically shows exactly that, exactly what you would expect. And what you see in the lack of arbitrage in all these markets and the breakdown of hierarchy. Not only does it show that specific case, but it actually shows the timing of it, which matches our perceptions of market behavior and all of these prices that confirm that there is an absence of banks and money dealers in these markets. And so the first chart is U.S. banks claims on foreigners. So that's the outbound supply of dollars from U.S. banks. What's notable about it is the central part, the light series, as opposed to the middle part, which the banking series. In other words, there are various channels for cross-border dollar flow. And the one that is broken down is specifically that to foreign banks, which, again, is confirmation of our theory that banks are absent and increasingly absent from these money-dealing spaces.
Now, I notice a trend forming here, because if I look at that first graph on page 8, that peak, which occurs just barely under $3.5 trillion there, that was in the spring of 2011. Now, if I look at page 10, I notice that the Eurodollar futures prices seem to change direction about the same time. So what's going on with the spring of 2011, and what is this chart telling us overall in terms of what happened in the first half of 2011 that seems to be showing up throughout quite a few of your charts?
Well, I think what happened and from a narrative perspective was that we had the event in 2008 that was shocking, and it was devastating in a lot of ways. But it wasn't necessarily a permanent rupture. I mean, it turned out to be a permanent rupture, but I don't think at the time everybody thought that was the case, including the money dealing banks who were at issue here. And what I think happened was that we had the panic, then the Fed came in with QE, and everybody kind of sighed a sigh of relief that, okay, this was going to fix everything, we'll go back to normal. And so between 2009 and 2011, there was sort of a partial restoration in the Eurodollar functions in terms of volume and prices and everything else that was captured by the Eurodollar futures market as a greater possibility of returning back to normal. Now, what happened in 2011 was that we had another dollar liquidity crisis, even though there had been two rounds of QE by that point, which to a lot of people and to a lot of banks in particular kind of blew open the idea that QE was money printing or that it was even stimulus. In fact, the FOMC transcripts from 2011 that were just released last month show a great deal of consternation and confusion on the part of Fed officials who kept saying that this was all happening, this breakdown in repo markets in particular, this was all happening despite $1.6 trillion in bank reserves. In other words, the Fed had supposedly created $1.6 trillion in additional money printing, yet it wasn't acting like that in any of these money markets. And so what happened in 2011 from the perspective of the banks was there was a tremendous difference in outlook and perception about volatility and risk. And that essentially I think, convinced them that they no longer wanted to be money dealers in any sense. You know, they were reticent about the restoration up to 2011, but after 2011, it was a pretty much a permanent rupture, so that the processes that began during the panic in 2008 were further cemented. And so it has been since that time sustained and complete withdrawal of banks from the Eurodollar.
Page 10 was showing us Eurodollar futures prices, from which one could, of course, infer effective interest rates. But now on page 11 and 12, we're looking at the Eurodollar money supply, which I presume means the total number of U.S. dollars that are on deposit with banks around the world, other than banks in the United States. Now, put another way, we're looking at how many U.S. dollars are available to the banking system. But considering that the U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency and is used to settle most international trade, how is it possible that this dollar supply has remained in a steady decline ever since 2008? Because the stock market is telling us that we're in full-on economic recovery mode and happy days are here again and everything is great. But from this chart, it kind of looks like the Eurodollar market didn't get the memo. So, Jeff, what's going on here?
Well, you know, the point with stocks is one that people bring up all the time, because it seems like there's a huge disconnect here, and I think there is. And the thing that we have to keep in mind is the Eurodollar system is not comprehensive. There's always been other sources of dollars and funding and currency beyond just strictly the Eurodollar system. And so there are different channels for financial flows to get into stocks, whereas they might not be in terms of the Eurodollar that we present here. And the reason for that is the Eurodollar that we're talking about is primarily a bank-driven system. You know, the only central banker I've ever seen who correctly identified it was the PBOC Governor Zhao, who said in March 2009, and correctly identified this as a credit-driven reserve currency regime. And what credit-driven means is exactly that, that it's a bank-drawn currency that isn't necessarily a currency. Because it's not comprehensive, it's not like everything has to be a Eurodollar. Primarily, the expansion before 2008 was done through the Eurodollar system through banking expansion, but these are not the only ways for money to transfer and transform. And so stocks, for example, have several different other sources of funds, such as corporate repurchases, other foreign central banks, foreign sovereign wealth funds, any number of ways where stock prices can be disconnected from the Eurodollar system. However, the Eurodollar system, being a bank-driven system, especially in a global fashion, is more economic-related. And I think that's why you see the economy being so bad after 2008, which is keeping very much in concert with what you see in the Eurodollar dimension. And I think I should add that, you know, what I presented here in terms of money supply isn't actual money supply. It's these various different dimensions of these Eurodollar capacities. Derivatives are one of the ways in which the Eurodollar system grew rapidly. And it grew rapidly regardless of what monetary policy was prior to 2007-2008. And so without that kind of bank balance sheet expansions, what we're really looking at here is the degree of banks who are willing to extend balance sheet capacity and consequently unwilling to extend that balance sheet capacity. And so it further adds to this idea that banks since 2007 have been missing from what is a bank-driven currency. And so that's an enormous problem.
On page 13, you're talking about the U.S. dollar index and bringing that into this story. And, of course, the dollar rally has been the biggest story in macro for the last couple of years. So, Jeff, the most common narrative that you hear in the industry is that the dollar rally is primarily due to reflationary policies, and that President Trump's focus on demanding the repatriation of assets by major U.S.-based international corporations is the big driver of all this strength that we're seeing in the dollar. Jeff, do you agree with that narrative, or is there another story here that most people aren't missing?
Yeah, I could not disagree with that more. And I think, you know, look at it. The dollar index rose more so in 2014 and nearly 2015 than it has recently. And the last thing that we could describe that period with is reflation. In fact, the dollar started to rise as a consequence of what we're really talking about here, where I say a rising dollar is a euphemism for a dollar shortage. And if you think about a dollar shortage as sort of a synthetic short position that global banks hold, a rising dollar makes sense, because whenever you get into a short squeeze, the price of whatever is being squeezed usually skyrockets. And so that's kind of the way I think about the exchange value of the dollar. The rise in it tells us that the dollar conditions or the dollar shortage has become that much more acute, which is exactly what happened in 2014 and 2015. I mean, you had various central banks all over the world step into these dollar markets with ad hoc emergency programs, which is usually captured in the upper level tick statistics as selling U.S. Treasuries, because these central banks are selling treasuries in order to fill the dollar funding gap that only grows that much larger and that much more problematic. So the rising dollar, to me, is not about economic strength at all. It's about the fragility and the malfunction of the global eurodollar system as banks further retreat from it. So as the private banking system gets out of money dealing, central banks are forced to try to offset that withdrawal as best as they possibly can. And obviously, you know, with central banks, they usually can't do that very well at all, and certainly not on a sustained basis.
On page 14, it looks like the summer of 2014, about the time that crude oil peaked, was where a massive sell-off in treasury holdings owned by foreigners began. So what's going on here, and what's special about the summer of 2014?
There's any number of events that have explained why there was such an inflection. But you're right to bring in oil prices here, because oil prices obviously are related to dollar conditions as well. You know, the commodity collapse that started at that point is very much related to the dollar shortage growing that much worse. And so what you see on page 14 is the official sector, foreign central banks primarily, selling off treasuries as much as they can without disrupting their own reserve positions in order to fill dollar gaps that are left behind as the dollar system and the dollar shortage gets that much worse. And so, you know, there has been a lot made about why are foreigners selling treasuries, and a lot of it is completely wrong, because a lot of it relates mostly to the fact that there's this dollar shortage that has gotten that much worse, and that it had destabilized foreign economies to such a high degree that they had no choice but to intervene in ways that are that they usually are very reluctant to do so. And they've intervened very heavily.
On page 15, you're showing yet again that there is a massive shortage of U.S. dollars. But I feel like there's something missing from this story, Jeff, because you just showed us at page 14 that there's been this massive sale of U.S. treasuries. And it would seem natural to me to think if you sell a whole bunch of treasuries for dollars, that would increase the surplus of euro dollars. But we're seeing the exact opposite. So where are the proceeds of all of those treasury sales going if they're not creating more euro dollars?
Well, look, what you see in 15 is where they're going. We're going back to the tick data, and it's foreign official institutions injecting dollars into banks. So, you know, on the one hand, they're selling their pile of treasuries to raise dollars, and then those dollars are not remaining on account in the hands of the foreign central bank. They're being lent, they're being forwarded, they're being all sorts of, you know, different transactions to banks in the U.S. and banks elsewhere, because the private money dealing system has retreated from these places. And so it's kind of a last resort effort, and sort of the other side of the chart before, which shows the selling of the treasuries. And so we have the selling of the treasuries, and then where do those dollars end up? And so it's not cumulatively an addition to the eurodollar system, but rather an attended offset to the overall private withdrawal. And, of course, it's nowhere near the same size or scale, which is why we have the problem. And, of course, that's the nature of central banking. Central banks always respond a day late and a dollar short.
On page 17, you've described in detail how international trade creates demand for eurodollars. So I'll leave it to our listeners to read that one on their own. Moving on to page 18, you're asserting that the Bretton Woods system was effectively replaced by the eurodollar system way back in the 1960s. So that begs some explanation. I mean, prior to 1971, we still had gold convertibility of the U.S. dollar. So how and why did eurodollars become so important way back in the 1960s?
Well, there's a couple of reasons, and you know, I should state at the beginning that we don't really know how the eurodollar market started. There's any number of stories for it. One of the primary stories you hear is that the Soviet Union, fearful of depositing dollars that they obtained in the natural course of economic business, didn't want to deposit them in American banks, so they started depositing them in European banks, fearful of the political consequences of, you know, perhaps the Kennedy administration was going to confiscate Soviet balances and such. There's other stories for how the eurodollar got started, but the way in which it started doesn't matter so much as what happened after it was started. throughout the 1960s, it experienced rapid growth, and it all happened pretty much underneath the radar until that by 1971, there was a tremendously deep Eurodollar market already in existence that when Nixon actually closed the gold window, there was something there already that had already taken much of its place. So instead of converting dollar balances into gold, central banks actually throughout the 1960s had been converting dollar balances into Eurodollar balances. And they had done so primarily to circumvent the Bretton Woods system. I'll give you an example. The Swiss National Bank in the early 60s had a statutory requirement where they held, if they obtained a certain amount of dollars, I forget what the exact level was, but past a certain balance in dollars that they acquired in keeping the franc steady as a fixed currency regime, past that certain point, they were required to convert those dollars into U.S. gold. But rather than do that, the Swiss National Bank had interests that coincided with the U.S. Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, and others who had formed the London Gold Pool in 1960 so as to limit the decline in U.S. gold stock. The Swiss National Bank in particular would swap these dollar balances above their threshold into the euro dollar market. The Bank of Italy did something similar. So the euro dollar market throughout the 1960s grew in a lot of ways due to official interventions in it that were already intending to get around the Bretton Woods system as it was. And so by the time the early 70s, the Eurodollar system was already functioning in a capacity for global dollar liquidity.
On page 19, we're looking at Chinese yuan exchange rates and banking reserve ratios. So how does that play into this dollar shortage story?
Well, what you see is that the Chinese currency exchange is a very good proxy for exactly the dollar supply, euro dollar supply in all these various formats. Since they removed the peg in 2005, it appreciated, and appreciated rather steadily and often very quickly, which matched the inflow of dollars from the euro dollar market, which most people know as hot money. Because of that tremendous inflow, the Chinese were forced to restrict its effects on internal RMB liquidity amongst its banks. So that's why you see a very good relationship between the currency exchange rate and the RRR, which is the required weight of reserves for the largest banks. And so as dollars were flowing into China, the currency value, the currency exchange rate appreciated, and the PBOC had to tighten internal liquidity because of it. After 2013, everything reversed. And so you have the falling CNY rate as well as a falling RRR rate, which tells us, again, the severity and degree of the dollar problem that is facing China.
The next few slides are about the Brazilian real. Now, are you trying to make a point here about Brazil in specific, or are you just using Brazil to further support your argument for the dollar shortage? And what are these slides telling us?
Well, Brazil has a similar situation as the Chinese do, that they're short of dollars. And after 2013, that shortage became a very big problem, as we know with the real's depreciation similar to CNY's depreciation. Without getting into too much detail about how the Brazilian dollar market actually works, which is kind of complex and counterintuitive, what you see there is the Banco do Brasil's, the Brazilian central bank's efforts to combat, once again, the dollar shortage by taking short dollar swap positions, essentially. And so it's further confirmation of the global nature of this euro-dollar banking problem. The absence of euro-dollar banks in all of these places creates this dollar shortage that we call the rising dollar, essentially. And so the currency regime, or the currency exchange rates that we see all over the world, aren't necessarily prices about what is each economy doing, so much as a barometer for the dollar system as a whole.
On page 23, it looks like inflation breakevens really started to take off again just around the time that you were last on Macro Voices last summer. So what's going on there? Why are inflation breakevens taking off, and what does this chart tell us in general?
Well, you know, nothing ever happens in a straight line. Even the euro-dollar problem has not been a singular event. It's not been a decade-long straight line of decay and dysfunction. It happens in specific episodes. You know, 2008 was a specific dollar episode. 2011 was a specific dollar episode. 2013, 2014, again, the same thing. So what happens is, in between these specific dollar episodes, where things look really dark and the economy as well as markets start to look really bad, in between these dollar events, people start to be relieved. Things start to look a little bit better, as markets are often do. There's a retracement past whatever pessimistic bottom has been reached within those dollar episodes. And so every instance of reflation that we've experienced so far has been after a specific dollar event has ended, and there's a renewed sense of hope has taken its place. That happened again in July 2016 as the last dollar event ended on February 11th last year. And so by July, it had been long enough time had passed and enough distance had been put behind that people started to be more hopeful about the economic future. But we shouldn't confuse that with actual recovery. You know, what we're dealing with is probability distribution. And so reflation in the sense, especially this last one last year, isn't even nearly as enthusiastic or strong as any of the prior reflation events for that very reason. The fact that after enough time, these markets have adjusted to the fact that the economy is going to be bad for a very long time until something actually changes. And so reflation, true reflation, is predicated on something actually changing rather than the hope that something might change.
When the Fed announced quantitative easing, a lot of us worried that if they printed too many dollars, that could lead to runaway inflation. But you have a completely different view, so please explain what the graphs on page 24 are telling us.
That was actually the first instance, in my view, of reflation. It was the idea back in 2007 that there was this problem that nobody really understood, but everybody thought, well, okay, it's probably a serious problem, but it's, you know, subprime mortgages. There's some financial irregularities. Some banks are starting to make some noises. But at that time, you know, the degree of faith in the Federal Reserve was still relatively high. It was as high as it was in the late 90s, of course. But people still had a lot of faith that the Fed was going to fix everything. And as everything progressed in 2007, especially later that year, it started to become more of not only would the Fed fix it, but because of the severity, they might overdo it. And so there was a fear that the Fed was going to overstimulate so as to counteract the subprime mortgage problem that was spreading. And so all the way up until July 2008, that was a prevailing view, that the Fed was not only going to be successful, it was going to be too successful, and that they started hedging against inflationary possibilities because of that fact. And not only would we avoid recession, the Fed was going to go too far and spur inflation on the other side of the minor subprime mortgage thing. What happened in July 2008, obviously, was the fact that everybody decided almost all at once that that wasn't the right interpretation of what the Fed was doing, nor was it the right interpretation of the dollar system overall. And so that reflation ended in reality, which was the dollar system was eroding, and it was eroding in a very dangerous way. And that's why oil prices essentially crashed from July till, I think, January 2009. The Chinese yuan forced the PBOC back into the currency market to peg it all over again at almost exactly the same moment. And so it was like somebody flipped the switch where the myth of the Fed fell from everybody's eyes and they embraced the reality of the dollar system, which was nothing like what everybody thought it was.
On page 25, you seem to be saying that we're basically stuck in a trap where we're going to have super low interest rates, and the Fed can't really do anything to change it. But hang on a second, because the Fed always can raise policy rates, and unless you think we're going to have a sustained inverted yield curve, it would seem reasonable to assume that longer-term rates have to eventually follow suit. So why do you think that we're trapped here with low interest rates?
Well, I think what the Eurodollar market, Eurodollar futures market in particular, is saying is that if the Fed's going to raise rates, it's not going to raise rates for long, or it's not going to be able to raise rates for long. If the yield curve happens to invert again, if they ever get that far, then it will immediately, like 2005 or 2006 all over again, it won't stay that way for very long. Either the market will force the Fed's hand, or the Fed will realize the error and correct it. But I think what's important about this is that in each of these reflation episodes, you can clearly see the market's faith in that reflation diminishes each time for these very reasons that we're talking about, because these markets have become attuned to the fact the Fed isn't exactly what everybody thought it was. Monetary policy isn't what everybody thought it was. Sure, they can control the federal funds rate, but as we noted at the outset, without hierarchy in money markets, what does that actually mean? It doesn't actually mean a whole lot. And so what you see in the Eurodollar futures curve, especially recently, how much flatter it's been, how shriveled it's been compared to the last bouts of inflation, reflects the fact that there is a sense of powerlessness about what about doing what we can do to get out of this mess. In fact, it, no matter what the Fed does, we're kind of stuck. And until something actually changes in a meaningful fashion, we're going to remain stuck for the long term. And by the way, I think I should add, the Federal Reserve actually agrees with that assessment now.
On pages 26, 27, and 28, you are comparing the 2013 and 2016 inflations using Treasury spreads, which, of course, is the difference between interest rates at various different Treasury maturities. So what are these slides telling us?
It's the same kind of thing as I was just talking about the Eurodollar futures. It's another part of the markets that reflect upon the idea that the probability scenarios for economic and financial future are much darker now than they were even three years ago. And the last inflation in 2013, when people were positive about recovery due to the tapering of QE, it was much more robust. It was much more enthusiastic. It was much wider and a broader adoption. Whereas now it's I think it's almost more of a media creation than an actual market creation. Yeah, nominal rates have risen, but the yield curve, the Eurodollar futures curve, swap spread, all these other things haven't really budged all that much. And the reason is, again, for the same thing that we've been talking about all along, is the fact that these markets realize that there's a problem in the Eurodollar system. There's no banking to be had, no additional marginal banking capacity being added. And without it, none of this stuff really matters. None of this other stuff really matters. That's the only thing that truly matters. And so if the nominal Treasury rates rise somewhat, that just tells us a little bit about the immediate future rather than what the yield curve tells us about the long-run prospects.
On page 30, we see that the 30-year swap spreads are starting to go positive just briefly in the summer of 2013, but they stay very firmly in negative territory in the 2016 inflation. So what's the significance of this?
Well, when the 30-year swap spread had been negative consistently since 2008. So for several years there, it was an indication, sort of a thorn in the side of the Federal Reserve, that something still wasn't right, no matter how many QEs they had done, no matter what. It didn't correct, and it was a very prominent signal that something remained wrong. But for a brief moment in the middle of 2013, the spread went positive again. And it was a signal to many people, and not without reason, that inflation was actually real this time, that there was a recovery coming. Things were actually going to normalize. With the spread going positive again getting back to hierarchy, it suggested that maybe banks were coming back into the system, and therefore the probability of an actual full recovery might be rising in a very real and meaningful sense. Of course, it didn't prove to be the case, and the fact that the positive spread proved to be fleeting. And where it really turned was, again, in late 2014, early 2015, with the reintroduction of this dollar shortage as a rising dollar. And so the difference between 2013 and 2016 seems to be that the swap market isn't to be fooled again.
So if I summarize everything that we've discussed so far, Jeff, you've basically presented a mountain of evidence from a number of different angles, all coming to the same conclusion, which is that we have a global shortage of U.S. dollars available outside of the United States. There's not enough U.S. dollars available to support the international monetary system. And for some reason, there's a breakdown where the bankers are not doing their job and they're actually leaving risk-free profit opportunities on the table. And you contend that all of this puts us in an interest rate trap that you believe the Fed cannot fix no matter what they do, that we're going to be stuck here. So what conclusions do we draw from this? What is this going to mean for the global economy in the next few years? And what do the last couple of slides in your chart book tell us about that story?
Well, I think what it means overall is until we fix the global dollar problem, we're not going to fix the global economy. And so we're kind of stuck gyrating between various levels of really bad. We go from, you know, the lack of recovery to what looks like a global recession to the lack of recovery and back again. So I don't think that changes, and that's why I think reflation is going to fail. That's also why I think reflation isn't that enthusiastically embraced as it is now, because I think a lot of these markets have come to the same conclusion, that without banking capacity, the Eurodollar market doesn't work, and it doesn't appear as if banks are coming back into the system anytime soon. And without them, there's really no chance of getting out of this rut. We've already lost one decade to it, and it looks like, you know, I hate to think of what the next decade might look like, because history is not very kind in these kinds of situations where you have prolonged periods of stagnation. I know the Japanese have put a quarter century into that condition already, but the rest of the world doesn't have that kind of social stability to allow prolonged stagnation or worse. So we have to at least consider how we get out of it. Whereas the Fed, on the other hand, because of how they've defined the last 10 years, no longer believes it's in its interest to do anything. In other words, monetary policy operates on what's called the output gap, which is simply the difference between current output and their estimated level of potential. Monetary policy is a specifically tailored to demand side, not the supply side. Therefore, if it's the supply side that's the problem, which is potential or trend, then there's nothing that the Fed can do about it. So what the Fed has done in the last couple of years by raising interest rates twice and maybe doing so again in the near future is they've essentially not validated the idea that there's going to be a recovery, but rather the opposite condition, that there won't ever be a recovery. Because what they've essentially said is that trend has been so deteriorated that there is nothing left for them to do. There's no more positive output gap for them to stimulate into. And so without a positive output gap, there's no sense in doing any stimulus at all, which is one of the reasons why the Fed has been kind of cool as to the suggestions of what the Trump administration might do in terms of infrastructure spending and fiscal stimulus. In a situation where there is no output gap, from their perspective, there's nothing for stimulus to actually accomplish. So I think that's a tremendous problem, too, not for the obvious reasons that we want them to do more QE or go back to zero interest rates again, but we want them to actually believe that there is something for them to do that's different than those things, just to actually view the dollar system as it is rather than how they continue to think it is, which isn't what it is. In other words, we want them to start considering the global currency system and how it actually is operating and failing, rather than their stylized academic approach, which doesn't apply. And until they're actually convinced that there is a role for the central bank in that condition, output gap or not, we're kind of stuck.
Jeff, as I listen to you talking about all this, I can't help but think like a politician. And you're saying there's this huge shortage of dollars. And rather than think about what the right solution is to that, it sounds to me, if you think like a politician, like an invitation, why not do a whole bunch more money printing? It sounds like you're saying we've got lots of capacity to do that. So can there and should there be another round of quantitative easing from the Fed? And if not, why not?
Well, I don't think there can be, or nor should there be. There's a couple reasons for that. I don't know how the Fed would actually interject anything that they do into the Eurodollar market. Statutorily, they're prevented from any kind of foreign interventions. You know, when they did the dollar swaps in late 2008, those were limited to other foreign central banks, and there was a great deal of consternation about the legality of it. So I don't know how the Fed would, if it ever intended to, do, say, something like a QEE, which would be a QE Eurodollar. So I don't know how they get into the Eurodollar market. And furthermore, the Eurodollar is much more than just bank reserves. You know, how would they affect, for example, cross-currency basis swaps? Would they start taking the other side of those trades? I mean, so there's a whole bunch of functional issues that would argue against any kind of intervention or any successful intervention. But beyond that, what we're describing with the dollar shortage doesn't necessarily propose a money supply solution. And I think what we're seeing with the dollar shortage isn't so much the shortage per se as the fact that it's a symptom of what is an inherently unstable system. And I think that's the answers that we need to start defining, is the fact that the issue isn't supply quantity more or less, but rather the instability of it. And so there's a shortage, I think, because the fact that the post-crisis period has been entirely unstable and getting more so. And so the reason banks are withdrawing from the system is that it's no longer tenable. And so the answer is not how do we increase the amount of more unstable currency, but to eliminate the instability in the currency altogether. And so that's not going to be accomplished by QE. And I think the only way it is accomplished is if we affect actual banking and currency reform that is not just piecemeal, ad hoc, and segmented. So there has to be some kind of, you know, whether you want to look at it like another Bretton Woods conference, a global monetary system, a global monetary get-together where people start to analyze solutions to the problems as they are rather than keep trying to apply Band-Aids that are not going to work.
So is there something that can and should be done here? Is it time, you know, let's imagine that you were put in charge of the world and could do anything. You say call another Bretton Woods-like conference. What should central bankers do at this conference? What action should be taken to solve this dollar shortage and get the economy back on track?
I think the first thing that needs to be done is to define the parameters that are required for a global recovery. And what do we mean by a stable currency? What do we mean by a stable system? You know, how do we go about achieving those kinds of things? And there are no easy answers here. And in fact, I would argue that doing a QE is much easier than trying to tackle these issues, because you're talking about a global system across any kind of, not only many different types of transactions and financial arrangements, but you also have all sorts of differences in currency systems and banking systems. And so harmonizing a globally stable system is incredibly difficult. And we know that from experience. I mean, Bretton Woods itself only functionally lasted about 15 years. The London Gold Pool in 1960 was essentially a default of the Bretton Woods system. So it's a Herculean task that lays ahead. But step one in that task is to actually recognize the problem as it is. And so, you know, doing more stimulus or doing more QE isn't going to solve anything, isn't going to do anything, just like prior QEs and prior stimulus haven't done anything either, because the problem is an unstable system.
Jeff, I would love to pick your brain for another hour on this, but unfortunately we're coming up against our time limit. Before we close, I just want to touch on what you do there at Alhambra Partners. I know that you're a registered investment advisor. What services do you offer, and where can people find out more information about your work?
As you said, we're a retail investment advisor located headquartered in Florida. They can find us at alhambrapartners.com, and we do portfolio management services.
Fantastic. Well, I cannot thank you enough for another fantastic interview, Jeff. I can't wait to get you back on the program next time to get an update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, that was a great interview. I really admire the way Jeff doesn't just make wild claims backed up by rhetoric, the way that so many people in this industry do. He knows he's going to make some pretty bold claims, so he does his homework and he backs up his arguments with solid data and some compelling charts. I love his style. In last week's postgame, we discussed straddles as a way of trading volatility, and we ended discussing VIX futures but ran out of time. I guess the question is, where do we start?
Well, I think that we should start off by quickly explaining the history of volatility and volatility products. The CBOE started publishing the VIX about 30 years ago, reflecting the implied volatility on 30-day options on the S&P 500 index. For several decades, it was just an index used as a barometer of fear and complacency in the markets. But it was just about 10 years ago that VIX futures contracts started trading, giving traders a chance to place trades directly on forecasting the direction of volatility itself. This led to an entirely new concept called volatility as an asset class, meaning that you can consider exposure to volatility as a strategic component of your portfolio. There's an old saying that when a crisis or panic develops, all correlations go to one, meaning that everything sells off at the same time, and nothing serves as an effective hedge for anything else because everyone is panicking and selling everything all at once. But volatility itself is an important exception, because when everyone is panicking and selling everything, volatility goes to the moon. So some exposure to volatility can be a very effective strategic insurance policy in a well-designed portfolio. Now, there's also the notion of trading volatility, meaning that you have a short-term view that volatility is likely to go either up or down in the near future. Back in the day, the only way that you could go long vol itself was to buy straddles, as we discussed last week. But these days, we have products that allow investors to make direct bets on volatility itself, either long or short. So let's focus on those.
And another critical point, Eric, is in the evolution of volatility trading was when they made available to the retail investor the ETF and ETN products. That is really where my problem lies. If the pros know what they are doing and understand the product, that's fine. But many retail investors and misinformed traders are lured to trading the product that they don't understand.
I'm not sure it's just retails. I think some of the pros don't really understand it either. But of course, the problem that you're alluding to is inherent to the term structure of the VIX futures contract. When VIX futures are trading in a steep contango curve, a trader that buys a VIX futures contract experiences an enormous negative carry, particularly if you keep rolling forward. Veteran futures traders understand the inherent drawbacks of a position like that. But retail traders and maybe less experienced professionals who buy the VXX ETN, who don't have futures trading experience, often don't understand that that ETN has to roll the VX futures exposure forward every month. And that means they incur that carry cost every month.
Exactly, Eric. The key thing for the average listener to understand is that the futures market, there must be a seller for every buyer for a contract to come into existence. The VIX is a unique product because there's nothing tangible to the product like oil or gold. Rather, it's a pure zero-sum trading game pitting traders versus traders, betting solely on the human emotions of fear and greed. The problem lies in the asymmetry in volatility. There are extended periods of complacency and then these big explosions in volatility. That asymmetry naturally makes buying volatility very popular to hedge portfolios and to gamble for huge profits. So I ask, who is the natural seller of volatility, especially when the VIX is already very low? This is where the contango curve comes in. It must steepen enough to incentivize sellers for undertaking the counterparty risk. It is the process of price discovery of finding equilibrium of having equal numbers of buyers and sellers.
You're right, and this is where the retail investors really get burned. They look at the spot price of the VIX index, and they see that it's down near the bottom of its historical range. So they think, okay, this is an easy trade because it has limited downside risk. It's already at the bottom of its range. So they buy an ETN like the VXX. The market subsequently remains complacent, and a month later, they wind up being down 10 or 20%, and they feel trapped in that position.
Oh, it can quickly spiral worse than that, Eric. Just as an example, 3 months ago, back on November 15th, the VIX index closed at 1337. Yesterday, the VIX index closed at 1197, or just about 10% lower. But because of the negative carry, the VXX traded from $31 down to $17, or down a staggering 45%. And that's the single leverage ETN. If you take one of those leveraged ETFs, like the ProShares Ultra VIX ETF, which traded from $67 down to $20, or 70% lower during that same period, this leaves an amateur feeling like a deer in headlights caught on the wrong side of that trade. But Eric, that brings me to the most interesting aspect of this. There is a new and ever-growing trend of savvy traders going short volatility to profit from this contango. It has started to feel like a free money printing press of just staying short, and that's always a red flag for me.
Well, this is exactly what Raul Paul was discussing with me in our interview a few weeks back. There are now historic levels of large speculator open interest on the short side of volatility. Raul didn't think that this was going to end well, and he suggested that it reminded him of the portfolio insurance fiasco that we had back in 1987.
It's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out. For professionals that understand the product, they can strategically position themselves. But I would have to argue that these products are not appropriate for as many as 19 out of 20 investors that I meet, even the high net worth ones. With that said, if you absolutely must have a piece of the action, I recommend using the VXX options, particularly using debit spreads. You can outlay a very small, defined risk that you can walk away from if you're wrong. And if you're right, you still have the opportunity for very lucrative profits. Or even better, you can just express the bet on volatility using a long Vega option strategy directly on the S&P 500 index options.
I'll add another word of advice, Patrick, which is if you're going to trade options at all, you really have to understand volatility and understand it well. Options traders are almost always exposed to Vega, that's the risk of changes in volatility, in one direction or the other. If you don't know which way your exposure is because you don't really understand implied volatility, you're going to get in trouble. So if you're going to trade options at all, you really need to understand the role that vol plays in valuing your positions. And of course, for anyone who may be new to the program, Patrick is in the business of teaching people how to trade. One of his offerings is a course that's entirely about options trading. So be sure to check out bigpicturetrading.com to learn more about Patrick's various online trader education offerings.
Thanks a lot, Eric. As a quick housekeeping note for next week's Macro Voices, it will be released Tuesday evening on February 21st, 2 days earlier than normal to accommodate travel schedules. We'll be back to our normal publishing schedule for Thursdays in the following week. Anything else you want to add before we close, Eric?
Well, we're really on a roll here, Patrick. Jim Rogers this week. I thought that our interview with Jeffrey Snyder today was one of our best yet. So please help us promote the show. The more that we can promote Macro Voices and build a bigger name, the more able Patrick is to get those really big name guests that you want to hear interviewed on this program. So please retweet us when we announce each episode. We have a new embedded player, which allows any webmaster to very quickly and easily put a Macro Voices player onto any website. You can find that by looking at the other embed options link on any one of the articles on our homepage. And most importantly, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. When you register, the more registered users we have, that's the statistic that Patrick uses to persuade our guests that it's worth their time to come on the program. So more registered users equals better guests in the future. The benefit to you is you'll receive our research roundup emails, which is a compendium of all of the links that we could find to cool free stuff on the internet each week. Patrick, what do we have for him in this week's research roundup?
Well, first thing and most importantly, you're going to find the link to Jeffrey's chart book that is referenced throughout the interview. But in addition, you'll find the link to the transcript of the interview included. Now, bear with us as it takes 24 to 48 hours to transcribe everything. So the link won't be working immediately when you receive the email, but just check a couple days later and you'll see the transcripts available. You'll also find an additional link to an article written by Jeffrey Snyder on Europe sets off toward Japan. We also have a link to an article from the St. Louis Fed on why economic growth keeps slowing down. And in addition to that, a Bloomberg article discussing how junk bonds may slam into a $1 trillion wall as maturity hits. You can find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, please email us at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library.
And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.